Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. In her new book, It's Life and Death, But Not As You Know It, From the Unbelievable to the Bizarre, author Tricia J. Robertson writes, in this book, I'll take you on a journey of seeming madness, from the hard to believe to the bizarre, which may lead you to think, now the woman has gone too far. I'll guide you through events which sound downright crazy, weird, and impossible, completely beyond your boggle threshold. But if you examine and digest the evidence presented, you'll be in a better position to form an option, to form an opinion about them. She'll present best evidence for the paranormal when Coast to Coast AM continues. A former teacher of mathematics and physics, Tricia Robertson was a longtime council member, being on the original council, past vice president, and immediate past president of the Scottish Society for Psychical Research. She was a tutor for the Department of Adult and Continuing Education at the University of Glasgow. In conjunction with Professor Archie Roy, she provided a session program of 22-hour lectures per session for the Department of Adult and Continuing Education in a series entitled An In-Depth Study of Psychical Research. This course ran for 6 years, examining the paranormal, what is evidence. In addition to 30 years of experience in investigating spontaneous cases, Tricia has appeared on various TV programs, usually documentaries, and on radio programs, and has been invited over many of years to speak to varied organizations throughout the UK and abroad. She's written the foreword to Dr. Mark Ireland's highly successful book, Soul Shift, and has text included in his book, Messages from the Afterlife. She has a wealth of experience in investigating spontaneous cases and has done so for around 30 years. She's the author of Things You Can Do When You're Dead, True Accounts of After-Death Communication, More Things You Can Do When You're Dead, and her latest, It's Life and Death, But Not As You Know It, From the Unbelievable to the Bizarre. Tricia Robertson, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Hi, good morning. It is morning here and morning where you are, too.
Indeed it is. Thank you for staying up late or early, as the case may be.
I'm early.
So
I'm
in this book,
bed.
Well, we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Compiling some pretty compelling evidence, not only in this book, but in your prior books. I mean, that's you put your best evidence forward. Do you still believe that there are some, let's say, scientific materialists out there that will look at this material and say, wow, this is worth further study? Was that your goal in mind, to try and convince some of these materialists that
no,
there is more to
not.
Consciousness?
The people who have made up their minds that none of this can be true will never look at the proper evidence. I wrote the books, with the intention of providing the man in the street, the man and woman, the ordinary man and woman, with evidence, because the hard-nosed materialist takes away any hope. If people are sad and they think someone has died and they'll never see them again. But I provide, hopefully, and I know I have in the three books, an enormous amount of evidence, not only my evidence, but evidence accumulated throughout the last 100 years. But you're quite correct, I provide the best of evidence. Why would I provide evidence that's not so good? And unfortunately, there is quite a lot of evidence, so-called, that is not so good. But the advantage of my books is it's not just solely on mediumship. It covers the subject of life after death from various angles.
Right, right. And I read, I cribbed from your introduction as we kicked off this hour, in which you were wondering maybe the reader will think, wow, she's gone too far this time.
Yep.
She's just way out there. Did you ever seriously think that some of this material, some of the evidence that you present here, might in fact just leave people thinking exactly that? Wow, this is too far. This can't be true.
Well, I can imagine a lot of people will think it's not the crazy. Everything in it is absolutely true. If I could just recap, you mentioned that I did university lectures with Professor Roy over the years, and in other places as well. But I had accumulated so much information, and I have so much personal experience of research. Archie and I also have a 5-year study of mediumship's information, which is in the, in a peer-reviewed journal in London, that are, we've done practical work, you know, absolutely sensible things as well. But for my third book, I thought, I'm going to look at the more bizarre shores of human personality, as it were, and just put out there, put in this book. I'll describe it. There are references there. People can go and find out more about it, and people can make up their own mind. Now, not everyone will accept it as being true, but I can assure you it's absolutely true, every single word of it. And as I say, I give references where you can go and find out more about these things. And I find that the more I go into this as a psychical researcher, the more fascinating it becomes.
I want to dive right in here with an extraordinary gentleman, an extraordinary case, and that is Gerard Croisset, a Dutch grocer in the 1940s. Just set this up a little bit. Tell us a little bit about who he was, and then we'll get into some of his remarkable abilities.
Yes, well, I won't argue about the pronunciation of his name. Archie and I always called him Gerard Croisset, but it might well be Gerard Croisset, but I'll just call him Gerard Croisset for the sake of this conversation. Gerard Croisset, I had to do a bit of research in this one, obviously, and he didn't really call himself a medium, a psychic. He didn't really call himself anything, but he had the ability to be able to know where people were and tune in, more or less, to what they were doing, whether they were alive or dead. Now, the Dutch police used Gerard Croisset for over 40 years in their cases, whether they be murder cases, thefts, whatever. And Gerard Croisset proved time and time again he had the ability to locate the body, if it was indeed a body, or if it was a missing person. He could tell them where that person was, what they were doing, and oftentimes what time they would be back at, which is quite outstanding. But as I say, you have to read the material to fully understand that. But the thing that really sold it to me about Gerard Croisset is the professor at the University of Utrecht was interested in this ability. Now, Gerard Croisset never employed a survival hypothesis. He never said someone departed is telling me this. He never said that. He always said, I just know. I think about the name, I think about the person, and I have the information. So the professor at the University of Utrecht set up an experiment to test Croisset's ability. And they designed this experiment much as Archie and I did in our experiments, not even knowing if it was going to work. That's the best experiment, when you actually don't know if this is going to work. If it works, it's amazing. So they set up this experiment whereby they chose a venue about 30 days in advance of the time we're speaking about. And they would say to Gerard Croisset, and someone else would organize a room, they would organize participants to be in this room, and they would say to Gerard Croisset things like, in 28 days' time, there's going to be a meeting in such and such a town. There will be 40 people in the meeting, and we want you to describe who is going to sit, for example, in chair number 9. And Gerard Croisset would hold his hand to his head and tune in, and he would be able to tell them with incredible accuracy the person who would sit in the designated chair, for example, chair number 9. And I explain that in much detail within the book. Now, the professors, of course, were extremely interested in this. So other people throughout the world did more experiments with Croisset. And Croisset did this another approximately 300 times with different professors in different scientific situations, more or less throughout the world. So his gift was tried and tested. Now, Croisset himself never took a penny, not one single dime, for his work. He always said, whatever this gift is I have, it's a gift from God, and if I misuse it or take money, I may lose my ability to help other people. And all in all, he was the most extraordinary man, which I discuss in great detail in the last book, It's Life and Death, But Not As You Know It.
Right. I mean, so principled, in fact, was he that he would even pay his own travel expenses if called upon by the police to do some investigation.
That's right.
I want to stick with I want to stick with Croce just for a few moments yet, because there's another story in the book, just to demonstrate to people the precision with which he was able to see events. And that had to do with a gentleman in America whose daughter disappeared, I believe, from a psychiatric hospital in Kansas, who had learned of Croce's ability and called him for help. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I don't have all the material in front of me, but yes, certainly they called Croce at midnight to say that they were very concerned about this lady who had disappeared. He was a professor of some kind. The details are in the book, and Croce just immediately tuned in and said, "Don't worry, she'll be back in." And he gave a time. Say it was 6 days. She'll be back home. She at the moment she's in. For example, she's in a red car. She's crossing a field, she's doing this, she's doing that. And don't worry, she'll be back. She's fine, she's alive, and she'll be back in about 6 days. So it came to the 6 day, the appointed day anyway, and Croce said, if it is not so, phone me back. So on the 6 day, the professor came down from his bedroom to the lounge to phone Croce and say she's not back. And to his amazement, the girl was sitting in the lounge, and everything Croce had described while she was alive was absolutely correct. To me, it's a kind of form of remote viewing, which, of course, is another thing we don't particularly understand, only that it happens. It's an actual fact. So there again, the woman was alive, and Croce said she was alive when she was back, and sure enough, that's what happened.
The big mystery to me is why we all don't know about Gerard Croce. Why is that, do you suppose?
Well, this is why I included Croce, and I think I say it in the book. If I didn't say it, I should have said it. All of these things, whether it's in 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, or indeed older than that, if the evidence is so good, it does not have a sell-by date. If that evidence has been examined by people of reputation, people with credibility, that everybody, this is why I wrote these books. People don't know about these things. I have to say, this third book is being they were all well received, but the third book is being extremely well received because people do not know about these things, and that is due to the media. I don't know so much about in America, but in the UK they're very sticky about these things. Anything I've done on public television is more in a sense like a documentary. But people do not know about these things. And I deal in what happens in the real world to real people. And that is what I want to show people. Look, we as human beings are more than the flesh and blood you're looking at just now. There's much more to us. And the third book I don't absolutely home in on life after death. I home in the things that we can do. For example, Croce. Things that people can do while we're still alive. And we are the most amazing creatures, human beings, and we don't use our potential. I include myself in that, of course, as well. And that's why I find it fascinating. And your question is a tremendous question. Why don't more people know about it? And in fact, this is recently I've had a communication from a Dutch magazine wanting to do, you know, an interview and an article simply because that have brought up the wonderful Gerard Croce.
And in your 30 years of investigations, have you come across anyone who comes close to his abilities?
No. In a nutshell, I'm thinking as I speak, but I would have to say no. Absolutely not. No. And the strange thing about Croce, which I don't know if I find it disturbing, I find it strange. Croce could appear, I don't have evidence for this, but it seems that Croce could tell you things that were going to happen in the future as well. And if he was asked to tune in to a time in the past, he could tell you in great detail from just tuning in as to what happened at that time in the past. Now, I don't have an explanation for that. I don't have an explanation for a lot of things in the book, but I only know they happen and they're true.
To what extent are you able to apply the scientific method when you're investigating these claims of the paranormal?
Well, for example, the professors at the University of Utrecht and all the other ones, they applied a tremendous scientific discipline when they organized what you call a triple-blind research test, an experiment, actually, 40 miles or however many miles, 60 miles away from where the man is actually living. There is no way that Kwasi or any, in fact, it was very blinded, so much so that when the person organized the 40 people to come into the room, there was another randomization process at the door where there was a shuffled pack of numbered cards. And as they came in, the people were given a random number as to what seat they would sit in. So nobody even knew what seat the person was going to sit in, far less how the seats were going to be set out. And Gerard Kwasi himself knew, and professor from Utrecht, he didn't know, obviously, who was going to sit in the seats either. So you've got a triple-blind experiment, which you can't do any better than that. In the experimentation that I did with Professor Roy, excuse me, I'm going to cough, we used the randomization shuffled pack as well. And so you can apply certain principles to these things.
Now, someone, I believe, from the United States went to Holland. They wanted to test Kwasi themselves, and they had these randomized cards. And Kwasi said, no, I don't work that way. I have to have an emotional attachment. What is the role of emotion?
I do not mean to be rude to you, he said to the experimenter. I think it was Dean Radin. I'm not sure. It's in the book anyway. He said, I don't mean to be rude to your experiment, he said, but I choose not to deal in cards. I deal with people and emotion. And you know, that's what it's all about. All of this, every single bit to do with psychical research, emotion plays an enormous part. There has to be emotion for it to work. It's like a carrier wave for all of this. Excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. Yes, emotion and intention definitely are the two principles in all of this.
And was that just so with Croce, or have you found consistently this is the case?
Well, it's consistent with all of these things, whether it's materialization or a poltergeist activity or mediumship, all of these things definitely need to have emotion for it to work. The person who's dead has to want to come back to speak to the person that's alive. If they don't have that emotion to come back and the intention to come back, it ain't going to work.
Now, we're approaching a break here, but I want to just begin the discussion now and we'll continue after as well. But I want to talk about retrocognition. I think I know what it means, you know, the idea of knowing about things that happened in the past. Tell us about a little bit about Dorothy Strong and what happened to her, because this is it really illustrates what it's all about quite nicely.
Dorothy Strong, was that the one at the Battle of Necktensmere, or was that the other lady in Scotland? I can't remember.
She was. She was kind of stranded on the road and was walking home at night in Northumberland.
Yes. There are so many of these cases. That's why, without having the details to my hand, I can't just bring the names to bear. Yeah, Mrs. Dorothy Strong. She was driving home. It was in the north of Scotland, actually, and her car broke down about 8 miles from her home. She had a little dog with her. So she decided she would just have to walk, and it was getting...
Tricia, my apologies. We've got the music percolating up. That means it is time to go to the break, so we will pick it up with this remarkable case of retrocognition. Tricia Robertson, the author of It's Life and Death, But Not As You Know It, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett and the website strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Prince Philip has spent decades, apparently, collecting a library on books on UFOs and aliens. His interest was sparked by his uncle, Lord Mountbatten, who wrote an official report about an alien in a silver spaceship landing on his estate. Philip apparently spent last summer reading The Halt Perspective, revealing the inside story of Britain's Rendlesham Forest incident. The book was co-written by retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Charles Holt, who was the base deputy commander, of course, at the time, and retired West Midlands Detective John Hansen. In a letter to Mr. Hansen, the Duke's private secretary, Brigadier Archie Miller Bakewell, wrote, "I am certain it will be read with close interest over the summer." After receiving another book, Haunted Skies, the Encyclopedia of British UFOs, the Duke of Edinburgh's right-hand man replied, "His Royal Highness will add this copy to his collection. It will make a most welcome addition to his library." Last night, Mr. Hansen said, "Why shouldn't any sensible person have an interest in a phenomena that has baffled mankind for millennia?" You can read more about Prince Philip and his passion for UFOs and aliens in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. And tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning, Ian Punnett will be in the Coast Air Chair. The Bible has been dismissed as a book of myths, legends, and propaganda, yet when we examine the archaeological evidence, its accuracy comes to light, according to Dr. Titus M. Kennedy, a field archaeologist and adjunct professor of Biola University, and he'll join Ian to discuss evidence for the historical reliability of Scripture using research from more than 50 museums, private collections, and archaeological sites. And also amateur astronomer and founder of the Exoplanets YouTube channel, Alberto Caballero, will share his research into a possible source for the mysterious WOW sign. And that's tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning, Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. Back to more of my conversation with Tricia Robertson right here on Coast. We're back with Tricia Robertson, the author of It's Life and Death, But Not As You Know It, From the Unbelievable to the Bizarre, in which she presents some very compelling evidence for cases of electronic voice phenomena, photography, psychokinesis, distant healing, xenoglossy, mediumship, and more. Right now we're talking about cases of retrocognition, and I was mistaken. The case I was thinking of was Miss Smith. This was the one you were discussing from 1950. That, yes. Yes, so yep. She's just very quickly, she's journeying home from Brecon in her car, accompanied by her small dog. Her car goes into a ditch. She then had to walk home approximately 8 miles along deserted farm roads. It was late at night, and she started noticing these figures in the dark moving to her right, bearing flaming torches. So if you could pick up the story from there, what was she witnessing?
Well, she didn't know what she was witnessing, of course. By that time, it was extremely dark, as it was 2 a.m. in the morning. And she could see there was a village in the distance towards the Dunnacan Hill. And as they approached the village, as you say, she saw to her right, about 50 yards away, figures walking round what appeared to be a loch. They were very, very old-fashioned figures in ragged clothes, etc. And interesting enough, they were carrying flaming torches, and the dog looked over, and the dog growled again at it. Anyway, she walked steadfastly on, and finally, leaving them behind, she realized in the morning, this is the strangest thing, absolute weirdest thing ever. And what happened with the figures? She saw the figures, and not only did she see the figures, it was as if she was seeing a battle scene, and there were bodies lying on the ground. And the figures she could see with the torches were lifting, turning the bodies over to look at them. And if it was one they didn't want, they would turn the body back over on its face. And if it was one that they did want, they would leave it with the face upwards. Now, unknown to her, she was actually on the site of the Battle of Necktansmere, which took place in 685 AD. Now, that's a hell of a long time ago. And I find it extremely interesting that the dog barks. Now, she was so concerned about this that she sought to a possible explanation for this. And she was investigated by a wonderful psychiatrist, Dr. James McHarg. And he went through all of the usual suspects, as we would say. Was it a hoax? But extremely unlikely due to her character of the woman. Was it a false memory syndrome? Was it something that was hidden in her mind? Perhaps came to the fore, but she absolutely, utterly denied any knowledge that there had been a loch there, because there was no loch there now. The loch she saw them walking about was not there in present day. Was it an hallucination due to the darkness, walking for so long? Anyway, James McHarg and company, they examined her for every one of these possibilities, and they came to the conclusion that no, she was a perfectly sane woman. There was nothing wrong with her, and it's an example of what I would call the stone tape theory. You can see it in many a battlefield, many a haunted place, many a castle where people have been killed, etc., where you see the vision like a video. You're watching a video. You can watch a video of Elvis Presley, but he's not there. It's a video presentation of what happened in the past. And this is what we call stone tape theory. And the vision, we'll call it the video of it, for it seems to be written in the space and time. It's because we're back again to this word emotion. Because there would be such emotion at the Battle of Nectansmere with all the blood and thunder and swords and killing. It's on the space and time. People can tune into what happened there and see this. Now, possibly she was able to tune into this because of what I call a change in consciousness. And you'll also notice in the book that I speak about consciousness a lot. And I believe that all of this is to do with our awareness, our ability to see something with a particular level of consciousness. Now, only some people can see that and some people can't. And this brings us to the huge question in the book is, who are we as human beings? What is consciousness and what does it allow us to do? But I see the other one you were thinking about, Dorothy Strong, she was surrounded by soldiers, and she was actually on the site of the Battle of Otterburn, which was fought in 1388. That was a different one completely. The taxi driver saw them as well. So two people saw that one. So it seems to be that some people can get a glimpse into the past, just as some people appear to be able to get a glimpse into the future. Now, I find that all very strange. It brings us again to the question of what is time. If these things happen, then what is time? I know a lot of the Eastern religions think that time is there, everything is there at all times. I find that difficult to conceive. It doesn't work with me because I've got a very, very logical mind. I'm not a medium, I'm not psychic, I'm just someone. I've taught maths and physics, as you know, and I just look at these things as to the actual evidence of these things. Going back to your scientific principles, you can certainly apply them to many things. The likes of these, we'll call them anecdote stories from these people, but there are so many of them that you have to believe that something's going on. And that is the interesting
And the fact that the dog was barking at something, it tends to suggest
that... And I found it really funny that she was more worried about the dog barking and awakening up the village than she was about seeing the men killing each other and lifting over bodies.
Right, right. So it suggests that this event was external, that the phenomenon was external. It almost sounds like a time slip. Is that related to this as well?
You've got to be careful here. You've got to be careful here. I wouldn't consider that a time slip, actually. I would consider that as part of what you call the stone tape theory, where you can see... something that happened in the past. No, it's not a time slip. It's a change in consciousness that allows us to see that from the time past. I don't know why it happens. We can argue about what it is. I don't think that was a time slip. I really don't. It's a different thing. This one's not in the book. There's a well-known story about the ladies that went to Versailles, the gardens in Versailles, and they had a lovely day in the gardens of Versailles in a particular part. And later on, they were speaking to people about what they had done in the gardens of Versailles. And they said, oh, that's not there anymore. They had actually spent time in a place talking to people in a different time. Now, that's a time slip. Actually seeing a reconstruction of a battle and a ghost walking along the towers of a castle, these are not, the people are not there. It's like a video in the space and time. I don't know how it happens. But I do know that it does happen. But everybody can make up their own mind regarding the evidence. That's fine.
Right. Is there something else related or in terms of possible causation, external forces, or let's say the geology of a particular area, rock formation, soil types, anything like that?
It could be. Many people say if they're on a ley line, you know, these invisible lines that are supposed to be all over the earth, there could be. That is not my particular area of expertise. It certainly could be. People say you can see them where there's water. It could be. I don't have, you'd need to go into a different kind of book to get that information. But regardless of the reason, these things do happen. People can get glimpses of things that happened in the past, just as people can get glimpses of things that happen in the future. Oh, and I personally do not like the idea of precognition, but that's too bad. I just have to say the evidence is there. Some people can definitely know what's going to happen in the future. Once again, some people might say time travel. I don't think so. It's just a facility that some people seem to have, which makes us even stranger as human beings.
Right, and while we're on the subject of precognition, I want to talk about Jean Dixon. This is, you know, someone I've seen for years. We saw her name splashed across the tabloid newspapers while we're waiting in line at the grocery store. Every year she would come out with her predictions and so forth. Yep. But I was not aware of the preciseness and how successful she was in terms of, for example, naming precise dates for assassinations, the partition of India. Let's start with the partition of India. This is a remarkable story.
Well, that's the one I like too. I like that one. Jean Dixon forecast that India would be partitioned. It was I think it was February 1947. It was a particular date anyway, February the 20th, I think. And at that time, an Indian diplomat based in Washington laughed at her. He scoffed, "Don't be so silly." He phoned it up. He said, "There's no way India is going to be partitioned." However, time went on, and on the morning of the appointed day, he telephoned Jean Dixon to tell her that her prophecy was unfulfilled. And her reply was, "The day is not over yet." And by the end of that very day, the story came out that India was being partitioned. And I actually quite smile at that one. That's really quite a good one. No, she was shown to be the real deal. She was always psychic from being a child. And she used to say that a lot of our premonitions, it would come to her in various ways, but she had two forms of premonition. One was premonitions about world events, and the premonition about individual lives, say your own life. She might have a premonition about you. Now, if she was having a premonition about you, she said that might not actually come true, because the premonition is based on your life at this time, what you're doing, and what you're plans are for the future. But if anything changed the path you were on, then it might well be her premonition was not true. But she said in world events, she said they were called unavoidable, because they were called revelations, unavoidable things in the world. The revelations were always true, because they were so big that not one single person's action could change them. And that's true of, you know, assassination of Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and so on, and the partition of India. And very, very interesting. She worked a lot for the American newspapers. I think there was a magazine called Parade around about the 50s and 60s. And she was shown time and time again to be the absolute real thing. And as for the 1960 election, she thought it would be not dominated by Labour and won by Democrat, but he will be assassinated or die in office, though not necessarily in his first term. Then she went on to give quite graphic details about the assassination of the president. Of course, she wouldn't know at that time in 1956 it was going to be John Kennedy. But everything she said came out to be absolutely correct. And once again, that was examined by scholars in America at the time and shown to be absolutely true. She was not a charlatan.
Do you believe that this is an innate ability, or is it something anyone can learn? Do we all have this ability?
I've no idea. I would think it's an innate ability, as is mediumship. There was a wonderful Irish medium called Albert Best, and Albert Best always said the best mediums were born mediumistic. It's something you just have as a child. It's like someone can be born to be a great artist, a great musician. It's just something you have. You can be taught. I don't know if you can be taught to do premonitions. I wouldn't think you can be taught to do premonitions. Somebody may phone in and say, I'm wrong, and I'm very happy about that, but I've never heard of someone being taught to tune in to give premonitions. You can be taught mediumship to a certain degree, but the level you attain won't be the same as the level that someone who's a natural medium has had since birth.
What's xenoglossy? I've never heard the term.
Who's that?
Xenoglossy.
That?
Xenoglossy. What is that?
Oh, xenoglossy.
Xenoglossy
is knowing something in another language, or speaking in a different language that you've never learned. Yeah.
Can you give me an example? Can you give me an example in the book of xenoglossy?
I do give an example of it, but I'm not going to tell you the full story because you have to read it for yourself. It's quite a scary story. This actually happened to Professor Roy. He had a phone call at Glasgow University from a psychotherapist who said that she was concerned about one of her patients. Since a child, she'd been having these dreadful dreams and nightmares about plane crashes and murders and all sorts of things. And she came to her for, psychotherapy. And she was a good psychotherapist. And as time went on, she began to realise this woman was describing all sorts of things about a man's murder. It was one of the German SS officers. And she began to become quite concerned about this because she was speaking in German while she was under hypnosis or therapy. And she, of course, did not speak German, and she asked Professor Roy if he would come down, with the patient's permission, of course, if he would come down and sit in a few sessions. And sure enough, she was speaking German, and as time went on, her German became more and more fluent. Now, the girl herself was just an ordinary person from Ayrshire in Scotland. She had no interest in Germany. But I'm not going to give away the full story of that because it's quite a really weird one, and I find it quite scary that these things can happen to people. But xenoglossy is when people start speaking under any condition a language that they've never learned and did not know. That's what xenoglossy means.
All right, we're going to head into a break. We'll continue this fascinating conversation on the other side with Tricia Robertson. It's Life and Death, but Not As You Know It, From the Unbelievable to the Bizarre. You're taking us into the break. Here's Kid Rock and Blue Jeans and a Rosary on Coast to Coast AM.